All right, let's kick off this deep dive and talk about early Israel, shall we? I know a lot of you out there are probably like, where did these people even come from? You know, what's their story? And we've got a whole bunch of like archaeological finds. You know, we're talking like real artifacts and ancient texts. Expert speaker, can you believe we get to work with all this cool stuff?
I know, it's amazing what survived all these years. We can actually hold a piece of history that mentions Israel, like way back in 1229 BC.
Whoa, seriously, what, like a time capsule or something? 1229 BC, that's like forever ago.
It's called the Merneptah Stele. It's not a time capsule, it's this victory hymn by an Egyptian pharaoh. You know, those guys love to brag about their conquests. And one of them, you guessed it, Israel.
Okay, so we have an Egyptian pharaoh name dropping Israel, but does that line up with like the traditional story, you know, the Bible?
Well, the way Israel is mentioned is super interesting. It suggests they were nomadic, not like, settled in cities like their neighbors.
So, like wandering shepherds and stuff, kind of backing up those biblical accounts.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we're getting a snapshot of them through the eyes of their enemies.
That's pretty cool. But, like, hold on, is this the same Israel from the Bible, or are we talking like a totally different group?
That's the million-dollar question, right? It's like one piece of a giant puzzle. It sparks more questions than it answers, Like, were these nomadic folks the same ones who eventually settled in Canaan? Did they really wander for 40 years in the desert, like the stories say?
So many questions. Okay, so we have this mention of Israel around 1200 BC. What happens next?
Well, over the next few centuries, there's this huge increase in settlements in Canaan, like a population explosion. Archaeologists call it, well, a settlement explosion. Catchy, right?
Yeah, I get it. So, like, how big are we talking?
We go from about 88 settlements to almost 700.
Whoa, that's a massive jump. There's no way a population just like grows that fast naturally.
Right. That's why people think this was like a major migration. Could this be those Israelites, finally settling down after all that wandering? The timing kind of matches up.
Okay, so we've got the timing. Anything else that points to these new settlers being, you know, the Israelites?
Well, there are some distinct features at these sites, like these four-room houses. They seem, well, pretty uniquely Israelite.
So if you find a four-room house, boom, you found the Israelites.
Not quite that simple, unfortunately. Dating these structures is tricky. And plus, sometimes you find similar stuff outside traditional Israelite areas.
Okay, so we need more than just architecture. It's like a detective story, you know? Gotta look for clues. Speaking of clues, what about those pig bones everyone's always talking about?
Ah, the pig bones. They tell us about cultural differences, you see. We find way more pig bones in Philistine areas than in Israelite settlements.
Is that because, like, the dietary laws in the Bible forbid eating pork? Makes sense, right?
It's a good theory, but the thing is, Canaanites seem to avoid pork too. So it's not a perfect indicator of, ethnicity or anything.
So maybe avoiding pork was just like a regional food preference back then?
It's possible, or maybe those early Israelites were more influenced by Canaanite culture than we initially thought.
So we're seeing these possible migrations, settlements, even food preferences. But how does all this fit into the bigger picture? What else was going on in the world back then?
To understand early Israel, we need to understand this crazy period. The Late Bronze Age collapse around 1200 BC, like all these major civilizations just collapse.
Whoa, seriously, like what? The whole world just fell
Well,
apart.
not the whole world, but these superpowers like the Hittites, the Mycenaeans, they just crumbled. Imagine like invasions, destruction, total chaos. It was the end of an era.
And this is happening at the same time those Israelite settlements are booming. That can't be a coincidence.
Right. Think about it. When those superpowers collapsed, it created this power vacuum.
Yeah.
And smaller groups, like those Israelites, could, step in. If those big empires hadn't fallen, who knows what would happen to Israel?
Wow, talk about being in the right place at the right time. It's like one empire's trash is another one's treasure or something like that.
Right. Yeah, something like that. And it's not just about empires and power. This period also sees the spread of, well, something pretty revolutionary, the alphabet.
The alphabet, now we're talking. Did that have something to do with like how those early biblical stories were recorded? It seems like a huge leap from like hieroglyphs to ABCs.
Oh, yeah, it was huge E. The alphabet made writing more accessible. It wasn't just for like super specialized scribes anymore. More people could write things down, record stories, and, well, potentially even contribute to the Bible as we know it.
So we've got this backdrop of like total upheaval, but also this new era of communication. And it's right during this time that we get those epic biblical stories, you know, the patriarchs and matriarchs, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, those guys.
Those stories are powerful, right? But we got to be honest, there's no direct archaeological evidence to prove those individuals actually existed.
Okay, so how do we like even approach these stories? Are they just myths and legends? Should we take them literally?
It's more about understanding them in their historical context. We got to compare them to other cultures and stories from the time. It's not about digging up proof. It's about seeing how these stories functioned back then.
Okay, I'm following you. Can you give an example? You know I love those light bulb moments.
Okay, how about the concept of the image of God in Genesis?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty powerful idea, right? But it takes on a whole new meaning when you realize that ancient kings used that same imagery for themselves. They literally thought they were like living representations of the divine.
Whoa, that's wild. So the Bible is saying like, no, everyone is made in the image of God. That's like a total power move.
Right. It challenges those old hierarchies and says, hey, every person has inherent dignity.
Still a powerful message today. Okay, we've covered possible migrations, settlements, food, the alphabet, but we got to talk about the big one, right? The Exodus. This story is central to, like, everything. But there's no solid archaeological evidence to back it up as it's described in the Bible.
Yeah, it's a big one and a tough one. Some people say it never happened. Others say it did, but maybe not as, you know, this giant Hollywood-style event. Maybe a smaller group left Egypt. Or is it more gradual?
So how do we approach this with like an open mind, acknowledging both the faith perspective and the lack of concrete evidence?
By being honest about the complexity, we can't just ignore the evidence, right? But we can look for clues and consider different interpretations. Like the Exodus story is full of specific details about Egypt, names, places, you know, stuff like that.
All those details have to mean something, right? Does it suggest there was some connection to Egypt, even if the whole thing wasn't as, you know, grand as the story portrays it?
It's definitely something to think about. Maybe the story is based on a real event, but it got exaggerated over time. Or maybe it's a symbolic story that captures a deeper truth. We got to keep an open mind.
It seems like we've got some challenging questions to grapple with here. Like, how do you reconcile the violence of the conquest narrative with the idea of a loving God?
You're hitting on some tough stuff there. Those are difficult passages, and there's no easy answer. The Bible itself presents different perspectives on the conquest. Like, the book of Judges shows a slower, more complex process of settlement, not just a sudden takeover.
So it's okay to wrestle with those tough parts of the Bible.
Absolutely. Faith isn't about blind acceptance. It's about engaging honestly and thoughtfully, asking questions, struggling with those difficult parts. That's how we grow.
Okay, good to know. Phew. It's nice to know we're allowed to think, you know, critically about all this. But are there any areas where, like, archaeology actually does support the biblical account?
Oh, yeah. There are definitely some overlaps. For example, the Bible talks about the Philistines as a major enemy of the Israelites, and archaeology backs that up. We found their cities, their weapons, even inscriptions.
Wow. So those epic battles between David and Goliath weren't just made up.
Nope. Archaeology helps us see the real-world context behind those stories.
That's so cool. Any other discoveries that shed light on the Bible?
Well, let's talk about Jerusalem. Archaeologists have been digging there forever, and they've uncovered tons of stuff.
Jerusalem. Such a significant city, even today. What have they found?
Massive walls, tunnels, palaces, even a water system from the time of King David.
Wait, King David, the legendary warrior king. Are you saying there's evidence he actually existed?
It's not that simple, but the evidence shows Jerusalem was a major city in the 10th century BC. And that lines up with, you know, when David supposedly ruled.
It's like another piece of the puzzle falls into place.
Exactly. It suggests the biblical account might not be totally off base.
Or like those detectives in those old movies piecing together clues from the past.
You got it. The mystery of ancient Israel never gets old.
So after all this digging and exploring, what's the big picture emerging? What are we starting to see?
Well, the story of early Israel is messy and complicated. It's a mix of archaeology, ancient texts, and, you know, lots of unanswered questions. We have to piece things together from multiple sources and think critically about what we find.
It's like our own archaeological dig. We're unearthing clues, asking questions, and realizing just how complex the past really is.
Exactly. And remember, as you keep learning about all this, keep asking questions and don't be afraid to challenge those old assumptions.
Great advice. So we've dived into early Israel, we've talked about their origins, wrestled with some tough questions, and now I'm like, where do we go from here?
Well, next up, we're heading into the period of the United Monarchy, the time of King Saul, David, and Solomon. Get ready for some drama.
Ooh, things are about to get interesting. I can't wait to see what happens next.
All right, so now we're getting into, well, I guess you could say like the golden age of early Israel, but also a time of a lot of, well, controversy too. It's the time of the United Monarchy. You know, those big names, Saul, David, Solomon, those guys.
Right. Those are like household names even today. But before we get into that, remind me where this whole United Monarchy thing fits into, you know, the big picture of ancient Israel.
Okay. So remember all those Israelite settlements popping up everywhere, like that huge population boom we talked about?
Yeah. Yeah. The settlement explosion. It was a lot of people all at once.
Exactly. So as those settlements grew, they started butting heads with, you know, external threats, like those Philistines we mentioned. They were a constant problem.
So basically the Israelites were like, hey, we got to band together or we're toast. They needed a strong leader to like deal with all these threats.
Right. They needed unity and security. And that, my friend, is where the monarchy comes in. And the first guy to wear the crown, King Saul.
Saul. Okay. What was he like? Was he like a good king? A bad king?
Well, the Bible paints him as like this tall, handsome, charismatic dude. A natural leader, you know. He had some early wins against those pesky Philistines, which, you know, definitely juiced his popularity.
Okay, so far so good. But I'm guessing things didn't stay perfect forever.
Yeah, not exactly. The story takes kind of a dark turn. He gets paranoid, makes some bad calls, and basically, well, he loses divine favor.
Uh-oh. That sounds rough. It's like a Shakespearean tragedy, you know. The kings rise and fall. So what happens next? Who takes over when Saul, when he's out of the picture?
This is where David enters the scene. You know, the famous shepherd boy turned warrior king.
David and Goliath. Come on. That story's legendary. It's the ultimate underdog tale.
Totally. But that's just one chapter in David's crazy journey to power. Eventually, he defeats the Philistines, unites the kingdom, and makes Jerusalem the capital.
Whoa, making Jerusalem the capital? That's a huge GE deal. Talk about a legacy.
Right. It was a strategic move that put Jerusalem at the heart of it all. And, you know, David's reign is often seen as this, like, golden age, a time of strength, unity, you know, good times.
All right. I'm starting to see why David is such a big deal. But what about his son Solomon? What's his story?
Solomon inherits a strong and unified kingdom thanks to his dad. He's known for, well, a few things. His wisdom, his wealth, and his love of building stuff.
Building stuff. Is that where we get that famous temple in Jerusalem?
Bingo. Solomon's temple was a major project, like a symbol of Israelite power and devotion to God. The Bible goes into a ton of detail about it. And get this, archaeologists have found evidence that supports some of those descriptions.
Wow, this is getting good. We've got Saul, the tragic hero, David, the warrior king, and Solomon, the master builder. It's like a Hollywood blockbuster.
It's definitely an exciting period, but you know, we got to remember, look at these stories with a critical eye.
What do you mean? Like, should we doubt the Bible?
Not necessarily, but we got to realize those stories were written from a specific viewpoint with a purpose.
Mm.
They're not just like neutral historical reports. They're meant to inspire, teach, shape a national identity.
So read between the lines, understand the context, and appreciate the power of stories to like shape history.
Exactly. And, you know, with the United Monarchy, the archaeological evidence doesn't always match up perfectly with the biblical narrative.
Oh, really? Like what? Give me an example. I'm all about those juicy details.
Well, the Bible describes Solomon's reign as this time of like insane wealth,
yeah.
Jewels, palaces, the works. But some archaeologists think the physical evidence doesn't totally back that up.
So maybe the stories about Solomon's bling were exaggerated a bit, like a little creative storytelling.
It's possible. But here's the thing. Regardless of whether every detail in the Bible is historically accurate, the United Monarchy is still this huge GE turning point for Israel.
So it's about understanding both, like the historical events and the symbolic power of those uncles.
Yeah, absolutely. The United Monarchy set the stage for everything that came after. It shaped Israelite religion, culture, politics for like centuries.
It's amazing how events from so long ago can have such a lasting impact, you know?
I know, right? And it doesn't stop there.
Mm-hmm.
As we go forward, we'll see how that legacy plays out. We'll explore the division of the kingdom, the rise of those prophets we talked about, and how those ancient stories still, well, they still matter today.
Okay, before we move on, I want to circle back to those ancestral stories. You know, the patriarchs and matriarchs are such fascinating figures, but like you said earlier, there's no physical proof they actually existed. So are they just myths?
It's more nuanced than that. It's not about taking them literally. It's about finding the deeper meaning. They tell us about the values, the beliefs, the worldview of the ancient Israelites.
Okay, I get that. But can you give me an example? How do we find that deeper meaning, even if the story isn't, like, historically accurate?
Let's take the story of Abraham and Isaac.
Yeah.
You know, when God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son.
Oh, yeah, that one. That's a tough one, even for people of faith.
It is. And it's a story we shouldn't shy away from. Even if we don't interpret it literally, it raises those big questions about faith, about obedience, about the nature of God.
So how do we make sense of a story like that today?
We ask ourselves, what does this teach us about the struggles of faith?
Yeah.
You know, how does it portray that relationship between humans and God? What about the limits of sacrifice, the importance of compassion?
Those are some deep questions. It's like these ancient stories are still speaking to us, you know, making us think about our own beliefs.
Exactly. They challenge us to think critically and have those tough conversations, even if we don't always agree.
I like that it's not about easy answers. It's about exploring these big questions. That's what makes learning about history so cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not about memorizing facts and dates. It's about connecting with these questions that have mattered to people for, like, forever.
Okay, so we've covered the United Monarchy, those ancestral stories, and we've talked about how archaeology and the Bible don't always agree. What else should we know about this period?
And let's talk about daily life. What was it like to actually live back then, you know, in ancient Israel?
Ooh, good question. It's easy to focus on kings and battles, but I want to know, like, what was it like for regular people?
Archaeology gives us some clues. We know that most people were farmers. You know, agriculture was everything.
So we're talking like a rural society, way different from, you know, those fancy palaces we were just talking about.
Yeah, totally. Life was centered around the land. People lived in villages, you know, often clustered around a well or a spring.
Can you paint me a picture? What did a typical village look like?
Okay, picture this. Houses made of mud bricks, flat roofs for drying crops, and, you know, hanging out in the evenings when it's cooler. Narrow streets, maybe a central courtyard where people would gather.
Sounds pretty different from our world today. What about their social structure? Was it, like, super strict?
There were definitely hierarchies, but family was huge. Extended families lived close, supported each other, shared resources, all that.
It sounds like community was super important.
Oh, yeah. It was essential. They needed each other to survive, you know, farming,
yeah,
raising kids, protecting each other from, well, from everything.
That makes sense. It was a different world back then. What about their religion? Was this like when Judaism as we know it started taking shape?
That's a good question, but it's complicated. The Bible presents like this unified view of Israelite religion, but archaeology suggests it was actually way more diverse.
Really? So it wasn't all about, like, just worshiping Yahweh, the God of Israel.
Yahweh was definitely important, but there's evidence that other gods and goddesses were also, you know, part of the picture, especially in those rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like monotheism, the belief in one God, developed gradually.
So it was more of an evolution, not just like a sudden shift.
Right. It was influenced by a bunch of factors, you know,
mm-hmm,
politics, the prophets, all sorts of things.
This is blowing my mind. It's way more complex than I thought. Okay, what about the laws? You know, like the Ten Commandments. Were those already in place?
Well, the Ten Commandments are traditionally linked to Moses and the Exodus, but scholars debate how those laws actually came about.
So maybe not literally handed down on stone tablets.
It's more complicated than that. The Exodus story might be symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
But the ideas in the Ten Commandments, they reflect values that were probably developing over time.
So it's more like an evolution of ethical and legal codes, not a sudden revelation.
Exactly. Those laws probably came from existing customs, you know, things people were already doing. It was a gradual process.
It's amazing how laws that seem so old and unchanging actually have, like, a whole history behind them.
Right. And it reminds us that even those super important texts, they're products of their time. People keep interpreting them in new ways.
This has been such a cool deep dive. We've covered so much. The monarchy, those ancestral stories, daily life, the evolution of beliefs and laws. It's crazy how much we can learn about a culture from thousands of years ago.
I know, right? And the story of ancient Israel, it's still relevant today. The themes of faith, struggle, identity, they're universal.
So as we wrap up this part, what's the one thing you want our listeners to really think about?
Remember that history is a conversation. We piece it together from different sources like archaeology, texts, and even our own critical thinking. Ask questions, challenge assumptions, and embrace the complexity. It's all part of the fun.
Well said. It's like we've been on our own archaeological dig, uncovering clues and getting a whole new appreciation for ancient Israel.
Totally. And as you keep learning, stay curious and keep that open mind. There's always more to discover.
Last time we were talking about how the United Monarchy kind of set the stage for a big turning point in Israelite history. So what happens next?
Well, things get a little messy. That United Monarchy, the one that seemed so strong under David and Solomon, it wasn't as solid as it looked. After Solomon dies, it's like everything just, well, falls apart. The kingdom splits into two.
Wait, seriously? All that work to unify Israel, and then boom, they split up. What went wrong?
There were lots of tensions brewing, you know. Economic problems, political rivalries, even religious differences. It's hard to keep a bunch of different groups with their own traditions and identities unified under one ruler for too long.
So it wasn't like one single thing that caused the split. It was more like everything just kind of boiled over.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, remember, these are real people, you know, with their own goals and grudges. And those things always play a role in these big power shifts.
Okay, so the kingdom divides. What are these two new kingdoms and how do they, you know, function as separate nations?
In the north, you have the kingdom of Israel with its capital in Samaria. And in the south, the kingdom of Judah centered around Jerusalem.
Ah, Jerusalem. Still a key player, even after the split. Did this division impact their religious practices, too?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Each kingdom develops its own unique religious traditions. The north becomes more diverse, you could say. They blend different beliefs. But the south, Judah, they stick closer to the worship of Yahweh as the one true God.
So politics and religion are like totally intertwined. Did they ever try to reunite or was it just constant fighting?
It's complicated. There were times they cooperated, but also a lot of rivalry and even war. This split really sets the stage for centuries of political drama, you know, shifting alliances and sadly a lot of violence.
It's like a never-ending saga. But in all this chaos, are there any, like, heroes? What about the everyday people? How are they doing?
This period sees the rise of a new kind of leader in Israel, the prophets. These weren't kings or priests, but these charismatic figures who spoke truth to power. They challenged the elites and called for justice and religious reform.
Right. The prophets, like Elijah, Isaiah, those guys, they didn't hold back, did they?
Nope. They were outspoken and dramatic. I mean, think about Elijah calling down fire from heaven or Isaiah walking around naked for 3 years.
Whoa, those are some intense images. But what were they trying to say? What was their message?
They were saying that true worship isn't just about rituals. It's about living a just and compassionate life. They called out corruption, injustice, the mistreatment of the poor. You know, they were fighting for a better world.
So they were like the conscience of the nation, holding those in power accountable.
Exactly. They were willing to risk everything to speak truth to power.
It takes guts to do that. Did people even listen to them?
Well, sometimes. It wasn't always immediate, but their words had a lasting impact. They made people rethink their relationship with God, with each other, and with the kind of society they wanted to live in. Their message of justice and reform continued to echo for centuries.
It's amazing how powerful ideas can be. They didn't have armies or weapons, but their words changed things.
Absolutely. And their message is still relevant today. Speaking truth to power, fighting for justice, holding ourselves to a higher standard. It's a message that never gets old.
Wow. We've covered so much ground in this deep dive. We started with those early mentions of Israel, explored the rise and fall of the United Monarchy, and even met those incredible prophets. It's been a wild ride. What's the one big takeaway you want our listeners to remember?
I want them to remember that ancient Israel isn't just about, like, dusty old artifacts and ancient texts. It's about real people asking the same questions we ask today about faith, identity, justice, the meaning of life. It's a story that still speaks to us, you know, even after thousands of years.
It's true. This journey has really opened my eyes to how connected we are to the past. It's not just dates and names. It's about understanding ourselves and our place in the world.
Exactly. So as you keep exploring these topics, keep asking questions, stay curious, and let those ancient stories inspire you.
I couldn't have said it better myself. A huge thank you to our expert for taking us on this incredible deep dive into ancient Israel. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this journey. We hope this has sparked your curiosity and inspired you to keep exploring the fascinating world of history. Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.